Beginning of the last summer, we did a 2-week series on money, and I kind of promised that we would talk about money once a quarter, and so now that it's been a half a year or more, I'm kind of obliged to talk about money again. So I just want to share some thoughts on finance, church finance, and then we're going to also kind of move into talking about this series, Walking with God. But someone was good enough to donate a copy of Randy Alcorn's book, The Treasure Principle for Every Family in the Church, and you're going to get those on your way out. And The Treasure Principle is a very short little book by Randy Alcorn, who's from Gresham at Good Shepherd Church over there. Probably one of the best books I've ever seen on stewardship and what it really looks like to hold in our hands kind of the possessions that God would allow us to have that really belong to Him. And that book, it might, depending on where you land on the subject of abortion, it's a really interesting thing because the story really begins with Randy Alcorn being in a picket line at an abortion clinic and losing a lawsuit to where his wages were garnished for a number of years, and coming to the conclusion that he didn't want his wages to go to support abortion clinics, which is what would have been the case. And so he really took a vow of poverty at that point and set up a foundation, and all of his work generated funds that then went to nonprofits, and he only took a minimum wage salary so that his wages wouldn't have to be garnished. And through that, it really taught him a lot. And when that expired, he continued on living that way. And so he's had bestseller books, has sold millions of copies of things, and really, because of the way God worked in his life, all of that is gone to support ministry. But that story is in the beginning of that book, and it's just a really interesting way to frame that, and then you'll see just the things that Randy has learned. You're going to get a copy of that book on the way out. But regarding church finances, I think one of the reasons why I have such a hard time talking about it, and I was thinking about it this morning again, is just the deeper you go into it, the more you realize how nuanced it is. It's incredibly nuanced, and it's very difficult to talk about something so nuanced in kind of short chunks and get it right. And so because of that, what happens is when we bring up a subject like this, there's always kind of the well, but, or yeah, that sounds great, however, and we're never able to sustain the conversation long enough to really unpack the nuance. So a couple things I wanted to do this morning just to kind of undo it. The first thing is the idea of a tithe comes in the third book of the Bible. You have the Pentateuch, which is the first 5 books of Scripture, the books of Moses, and you've got Genesis and Exodus, where you really see the starting of the story and then the Israelites moving into and being called to this place called the Promised Land. And then in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, you see really kind of the outworking of that, the idea of the law being given, these people coming to learn what it means to be the people of God, what God requires of man, and then eventually we see them moving fully into the Promised Land in the book of Joshua. But you see this idea of the tithe come in as God's beginning to explain to his people what's going on. It shows up in the 3 books, the last 3 books of the Pentateuch, and then the rest of the Old Testament all the way up until the book of Malachi. And then you get this interesting thing where you see the new covenant come about. And the tithe, by the way, is just a word. It's an English word for tenth. And, you know, tithing means tenthing is really what it means. And it's this idea of setting aside the first portion of what it is, your harvest or whatever it is that's going to sustain you, as a faith measure to give back to God. And it's an interesting thing because we can easily devolve into thinking it's a utilitarian thing, that somehow giving this back to God is a symbolic thing that doesn't really have to do with anything. Or some people actually felt like that God was being fed somehow by setting aside this food and bringing it to the temple, that in a weird, almost kind of pagan way, that was food that would end up on the table of God. And they would think this kind of thing, that this is actually how we're taking care of God in some strange way. And God continues to come back and say, I don't need it. It doesn't feed me, but it's symbolic because it belongs to me. And if you hold back that tithe, God says in Malachi, you're actually robbing me because you're holding on to something that isn't yours. And because you're holding on to something that isn't yours and you're robbing me, I'm actually engaging with you in a certain way, disciplining you to where you're going to finally come and say, I'm going to live submitted underneath you, God, rendering to you what is yours and living by faith. And because I'm living by faith, now you can prove yourself faithful. Because I'm willing to trust you, you can now take care of me. But when you're over here saying, I'm going to use all that I have to somehow figure out my life so that I don't have lack or I'm not in need, when I'm in control over here, I'm really trusting what I have or my own resources to make it all work, and God doesn't really enter into that equation. And so God in the book of Malachi is saying, no, I'm actually going to bend you back to living in submission to me where you have to trust me. And test me in this. This is God's language in the book of Malachi. Test me in this. If you bring to my temple, if you bring to my house your tithes and your offerings, I will open the storehouses of heaven and bless you and take care of you. We don't do it for the blessing, but what happens is God is saying, when you trust me, then you'll see that I'm trustworthy. And that's only going to affirm and encourage you to trust in me all the more. We all know that when we don't know whether we can trust something or not, we tiptoe into it and say, is this ice really going to hold me? Or is this person really going to fulfill kind of the promise they made to me? And we go in gingerly and cautiously. And what God is really saying here is, I know you might start that way, but try this, test me in this, bring your trust to me so that I can demonstrate to you the full measure of my faithfulness. And in doing so, that's only going to affirm you. And then this cycle of your dependence on me and my faithfulness to you is going to just grow and grow and grow. And so there's this fascinating thing. And then we get to the New Testament coming off of this. And a lot of people will say, so now in the New Testament era, there's no such thing as tithe anymore. Why? Because that was a law and all laws have been abolished. Well, no, not all laws have been abolished. The heart of almost every law, which is really love, loving God and loving others, remains. We don't steal. We don't kill. We treat our fellow man the way we're supposed to. That law, Jesus says, if you love, you have fulfilled the law. So the idea is we're looking at the heart of why God commanded the things he did in the moral code, not the symbolic kind of ceremonial code, but the moral code, and how that somehow affects our love of others. And by affecting our love of others, it affects our love of God, that those two things aren't separate. We love God partially by loving others. Jesus talks about that in Matthew 25. If you love these people, it's a love language that you're showing to me because I care about them. So by loving others, we love God. So we come to the New Testament, and so now all of a sudden, is this idea of a tithe gone? And I don't think it is. I think this idea is that all of what we have belongs to God, and we bring our resources to the community, both as a way of loving God and honoring him, our hearts being in the right place, trusting him, and as a way of loving others. And so you see this wonderful thing in Acts 2 begin, where the New Testament community is bringing their resources to the apostles, setting it at their feet, and saying, here it is. And the apostles then distribute it to everyone as they have need. Everyone as they have need. And so here's where one of the biggest challenges to the idea of tithing comes in. People say, you see, all of that money was supposed to be for the poor. All of that money. And the answer to that is no, not all of that money. The apostles that they were bringing it to were Galilean fishermen living in Jerusalem doing ministry. They didn't have relatives whose houses they were staying at. They weren't fishing in Jerusalem. They were living off those tithes and resources too, just like their leader had taught them. Because Jesus, in his ministry life cycle, wasn't a carpenter. He was a rabbi, and it was wealthy women who were providing for him as he went along and ministered full-time. In fact, that's how Paul, even though he worked as a tent maker while he was in Corinth, for much, if not most of his ministry, was living off of the tithes and the offerings brought to the synagogues when he was talking to Jewish Christians that were receiving him, or to the meeting that was happening with Christians that had left the synagogue and were now meeting as the people of Jesus, followers of the way. And so what you see is, just like in the Old Testament, that the tithes and offerings brought to the temple facilitate kind of the nucleus of the Christian community. And with the overflow of that, or with the bounty of that, it then gets distributed as benevolence or love to those in need, the orphan and the widow, or the foreigner or stranger, who again doesn't have a place to live because he doesn't have relatives in a very, in a culture like Africa or other places if you went to today, where family, an extended family or tribe really matters. So you see this really interesting thing set up, but I think there's pushback that comes against this idea of tithe, and I really try and get at the heart of why there's the pushback. And I think the first one is, what is the money going to? And it's easy to say it's different than the Old Testament, when in fact there's a continuity between it. There's suspicion of churches, because I do think there have been excesses in churches. And so I think that when we don't trust the church, we don't feel as excited about rendering money into the tithes and the offerings. I would simply say to that Antioch is in an interesting situation. I think I'm the only one, not the only one, I probably believe strongest of all the people I know that meeting in a rented facility like this, that's cumbersome in a lot of ways, is a cool thing to do, because it's like using every part of the buffalo. All of the rent money we spend here goes directly into the school system. We just crossed $450,000 that we've rendered to the school system because we meet here. I think that's really cool. I think it's a better way of doing it, and to say we're stewarding the resources that we have. If you look at our budget and the staff that we have, we milk a dollar better than almost any church I know. We do a whole lot of ministry with very little resources. And so I don't think that's my concern, that somehow we're wasting resources. I think the other thing that's interesting is that we get into this habit of being skeptical of the church in America because the brand of the local church has fallen on hard times. The church, the local church in America, is a lot like Radio Shack. You're laughing because you know exactly what I mean. Its brand has fallen on hard times. It's not energized anymore. It's not the cool thing anymore. Half the people are waiting for it just to go away and be taken over or replaced by something else, something better. And maybe we'll get excited about that next thing. But the local church, for most Christians, is some weird thing that we've been socialized to believe is dated or somehow tired or somehow older. And so because of that, we don't get behind it with our resources, because we put our resources, frankly, where our passions are. And if we're not excited about the local church, we don't bring our resources or our wealth to it. And it exposes a real hypocrisy in the American church, which is, we'll walk into a church and submit our hearts and our minds and our soul, our spiritual life, and that of our kids to a local church, but then say, I don't know if I trust it enough to have my money. And what we're really saying is that somehow we've elevated finance and resource above how we see our own hearts or the hearts of our children. And do you see how ironic that is? That if this is really where we're going to entrust ourselves spiritually and put down roots and trust our kids, that we ought to be willing to say, once we've done that, we're all the way in. We're not shopping for another church anymore. We're not looking for whatever the latest and greatest is. We're not doing who knows what. And we're also bringing our resources because we want to see this thing thrive And we want to see it be all that it can be. And we want to make sure that it has enough to do an adequate job at what it sets out to do in terms of its mission and vision in reaching those that are in this community and then those in the city and then beyond that. Just like Jesus said, you're going to be witnesses. All of us are going to be witnesses to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. Meaning, where you're planted, your extension of friends, both in the community of faith, Judea, and not in the community of faith, Samaria, and then beyond that even, where you're going to have to really work hard or sacrifice to get somehow the good news to those people. That the resources we bring are going to ultimately dictate to what degree we can have success in that. It's this crazy, crazy thing. Another way of looking at it is simply this. In Bend, people tip pretty well. Have you noticed that? And I think it's because no one in Bend wants to be known as someone who doesn't tip very well. And so it's, 15 to 20% is an easy thing that you see almost anywhere you go, and I think in any meal. That we value that. We want to honor those people. We want to be known. It's a small town. To those people. By the way, this isn't true at Starbucks. I hear from Starbucks people that nobody tips. And they always know exactly who's in their church. Just, you've been warned. But at restaurants, people tip really well. We want to be known as people that tip. So we go to 15 to 20%. A lot of you shop at Whole Foods and you spend 20 to 30% extra because you value what's being brought in terms of the quality or where it's sourced. Half of us eat at Jackson's Corner for the same reason and pay like 80% more than. I take that back because I don't know if that makes me liable to some kind of lawsuit or something. So I retract that. But Jackson's Corner, some of the best food you're gonna get in this town, and it's from local farms, locally sourced, prepared in a way that's fresh, and we value that, so we pay that extra money. And then I think we come to church and we say, this tithe thing, I don't think it really holds anything in the New Testament era anymore. I don't think it really speaks to me. I don't know that I really trust the local church. I don't know that this is really a priority. Isn't there a better place to put money? And we begin to treat it a totally different way than what we make, than how we make decisions with some of these other things. And I just want to call that out and say, for a lot of us, me included, the challenge here is to say, if the local church is the institution that's going to survive death even, do you know that your marriage, the institution of marriage, won't survive death? In heaven, we're not given in marriage. That's what Jesus said. But the local church gathers in heaven and the bride comes to the bridegroom. The bride of Christ comes to the bridegroom. And the fulfillment of what church can be eventually grows in and is instantiated in heaven there. And if we recognize that this is God's plan A and that somehow the local church, the body of Christ, is this valuable, valuable thing, that if we neglect, we're neglecting the body of Christ. I mean, again, do you see the irony? We want to do small groups and learn to know Jesus better and to show Jesus how much we love him and to clamor for a greater intimacy in that relationship. And we do all these things and we don't realize the irony of neglecting the body of Christ. And it would be just as if one of us, someone was really after our love and attention, and they really want our friendship and our intimacy, yet they didn't care for our body. They just wanted somehow our head. And I mean, this happens. I'll sometimes be talking, and one of my daughters will come up and be in need and have a tear in her eye and grab on my leg. And sometimes I'm talking to someone, and they'll look down at my daughter, and they'll get annoyed because she's interrupting the conversation. And when that happens, I always have the exact same thought, which was, if you really wanted a relationship with me, if you really understood my heart for my family and for my children, you would have recognized that this was more important than the conversation you were having with me. And I would have developed respect for you. And I think Jesus is looking at, and we see this in Matthew 25, we see it in Isaiah 58, where he talks about true fasting. And this idea of we can clamor for God or clamor for Jesus sometimes and want to have this conversation and get annoyed at the very human things that we think are interrupting or cutting in on what it is we're wanting in terms of this intimacy with God. And God is saying in Isaiah 58, don't you understand that true fasting, true talking to me, true clamoring for intimacy with me is actually demonstrated best when you love those who I love, when you take care of the body, when you show priority to that. Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, verse 9 and 10, do not grow weary in doing good, for at the proper time you'll reap a harvest if you do not give up. So therefore, do good to all men, especially those who are part of the family of believers. He puts a priority on it and says, that fatigue you have, you think you care about church but no one else does? You think you're serving and getting worn out and not enough people are helping? You think it's too hard because the brand name of the local church is kind of stale on your friends? You think it's hard to be a Christian and to really lean into that? You think doing good or living this out is a difficult thing? Don't give up. It will bring about a harvest. There will be a bounty that comes if you don't give up. Trust God in this. And as you're walking forward, therefore, continue to do good to all people, starting with the family of God. You can't neglect the family of God and run to anywhere else and say, I'm going to jump in and get involved in justice because that's cool, but this isn't cool, and so I'm going to treat this lightly. Or Christians around the world, the solidarity that we should have with persecution. For girls as young as 5 that are being raped in Pakistan and that are Christian girls and no charges brought, nobody following up on it. The things happening, and we all are aware of kind of the news, the solidarity that we should have for our brothers and sisters in Christ who are crying out. That there's a deeper issue here that's not about tithing, it's about our heart. And our heart really is what leads us. And so God is saying, I want your heart invested. I want your heart invested in the community of faith. And if you withhold resource, it's hard to say that your heart is truly there. If you bring resource, you bring not just your wealth, you bring your whole heart. And chances are you're going to involve yourself in all sorts of other ways. When I was working for World Relief, doing consulting on the side, you guys know we've had a long relationship with World Relief. I was privileged to these studies that showed the rate of giving in America, charitable giving, philanthropic giving in America. And the craziest thing about it was overwhelmingly about three quarters of the amount of money given philanthropically to nonprofits in America comes from a particular subgroup. And that particular subgroup is the subgroup that tithes regularly to a local church. It's amazing. But the people who give the most amount as a whole block to nonprofits or to justice-related organizations are those that are already tithing to a local church. What do you conclude from that? What you conclude is when you're already giving and seeing resource as belonging to God and trusting Him for that and recognizing that somehow as we invest into the life of faith, we're bringing solidarity to others into our life, that then spills out into generosity with child sponsorship or supporting organizations we know that are invested into causes we care about, IJM or anything like that. It's fascinating. The people who are already tithing are the ones that give the most. So for me, why do I bring this up, or where's my heart really in it? It's not to put any pressure on anyone or to make it legalistic. It's to dream. Like, I'm an idealist. and I like to dream. And I like to dream about the possibility of what happens when the community of faith comes together, the entire community of faith, and turns loose their resource. You know, the difference between an institution and a movement is the same as the difference between a fire in your fireplace versus a bonfire. It's the amount of fuel. You want to know what can make a church, I mean, exciting and buzzworthy quicker than anything else? Having enough resource to really engage in some really cool ministry and make a splash, both in the community, with kids, with youth ministries, and also in this town with the needs that are going on through FAN or Shepherd's House or other. You want to know what gets exciting is simply fuel. That's what I see happening in Acts 2. That there was so much excitement that people were selling properties, they were selling homes, they were bringing it, and they were throwing gas on the fire. And it was so cool that people were looking at that and they were saying, I want to take part in that too. And it began to be contagious. And so other people were saying, it's going to be more fun for me to give this away than to keep this. And it just began to influence more and more people. And to me, that's what I'm always hungry for, is that possibility that there's seasons where it catches hold and it really turns into a bonfire, and the people that are here are going, this is a movement more than anything else. And if you knew the excitement that's been generating just since Pete and Jarell got here, it's unbelievable, the potential to me for this next season of ministry at Antioch. I love it. I love it. In fact, this has nothing to do with anything, but I actually tried to pawn off speaking on money to Pete, the new guy. And in this little exercise, I learned just how secure he is as an individual and how mature he is as an individual and how easily he's able to say no. And there's parts of me that respect that, right? But so here's the deal. I would love for this church to own this church, for the people here to be bought in completely, which often starts financially, and that we would be regular givers in faith, trusting that somehow God's going to bless that and multiply it. I get giddy thinking about the days when a large gift comes in. These days, it's usually not selling of a field, it's selling of stocks or donating of a car. But there's been four or five times in the life of Antioch where a large gift has come in. And I'll tell you that the month or two after those large gifts have probably been, in the last 6 or 7 years, the best months of sleep that I've had. A very human level. The times I've been able to sleep with the least amount of stress and the greatest amount of excitement and dreaming about possibilities to the greatest degree have been on the backs of large gifts or donations. And I think there's something so beautiful about the people that do have resource, that can see it as something that they're going to bring to the church. When they choose to invest in the church that way, what it can actually do to refresh and encourage the staff, the elders, the lead team. And so I pray regularly for that. And so my hope is simply that as a community, we'll be able to be faithful. As some individuals within this community, that you'd be able to be extravagant, and that we'd be able to not want for resources to do what we feel like God is calling us to do in this city. That's what I got to say. Pete told me a story. I like the analogy, but he said there's a story about a guy going up to three guys laying bricks for a wall, and asked the first guy, what are you doing? And the first guy says, I'm laying bricks. And he asks the second guy, the second guy says, what are you doing? He says, I'm building a wall. And then he goes to the third guy and says to the third guy, hey, what are you doing? He says, I'm a part of constructing a cathedral. And I think that really speaks to, I think, my heart with regard to this idea of tithing or resource. That if we really understand it right, if we don't buy into the socialization of the church as Radio Shack, but if we buy into the theology of the church as the bride of Christ, that we would recognize that our service, our time, our energy, our words of encouragement to each other, our finances, that all of a hosting of an intern this summer, that all of that is a part of us as a body coming together and building something beautiful, a cathedral.